start again. Thank you, and I'm very excited to be here to present. Sorry, let's go to the first slide. Or we can just... Yeah. Beyond interim injunctions and the cross-undertaking in damages. My focus will be primarily on the pharmaceutical industry, but I'm very excited to hear whether any of you have seen any of these issues. Okay, well, we went to the second slide, but we... if you've seen any of these issues in other fields as well. And just to get everyone on the same page, let's quickly recap what interim injunctions are. And we are on the correct slide. Put simply, an injunction is a court order prohibiting a person from doing something or requiring a person to do something. And in the pharmaceutical sector, most interim injunctions are court orders restraining a company from placing a generic on the market. But patentees are not automatically entitled to injunctive relief. They must satisfy three main steps. First, they must show that there is a serious issue to be tried. Second, they must show that they would suffer irreparable harm should the injunction not be granted. And here, the courts usually assess the adequacy of damages both for the claimant and for the defendant. And third, if damages are an inadequate remedy for both parties, the courts do the balance of the convenience test, whereby the aim is to find the route resulting in the least risk of injustice should the injunction prove wrong once the case has been adjudicated. But my focus in this presentation is on step two, harm and damages. And this brings us to the question of abuse. And my claim is not that injunctive relief is problematic by its very nature. I recognize, okay, still on slide two. But it's on slide three on mine, sorry.
Okay. Use this.
Yeah. Even better. Thank you so much. Next time I will also print out like everyone else, not try something fancy. But to get back to it, my claim is not that interim injunctions are problematic by their very nature. I recognize that they are a legitimate tool necessary to stop imminent and potential patent infringement. But in my view, there's also reasons to question their use in certain cases. And using Lionel's very helpful analysis in the conference program, I'm going to address the question of abuse in relation to enforcement and weaponization and harming the interests of others. So firstly, going into enforcement, the 2009 European Commission Pharma Inquiry Report found that actors use injunctive relief strategically to disincentivize and deter generics from entering the market. And this is done by entangling the generic through serial patent litigation with the aim of financially overburdening them. And most interestingly, the report found that patentees will do this even if they know or strongly think that the patent is invalid and will be invalidated in the end. And second, and going into where interim injunctions can be weaponized for some other purpose, injunctions can also be used, and we'll be discussed this later, to gain a strategic market advantage. And in two of the cases, the patentee either launched its own generic whilst the injunction remained in effect, or it signed agreements with another generic company, allowing them to launch authorized generics. But when this happens, the first mover generic, the one that was subject to the interim injunction, they will lose a large portion of expected market share and associated profits, because when they enter the market, competition is already on there. And third, when injunctions enforce... No, correct slide. We're still on, still on number three. This is a long slide. Third, when injunctions enforce invalid patent rights, they help to unduly delay generic market entry, give a market opportunity to which the patentee was not entitled, and they hinder competition. And sometimes injunctive relief can even extend the market protection of branded drugs because certain courts, like the English, will uphold injunctive relief even if the patent has been invalidated at first instance. Fourth, there's also an incentive issue. Actors have a significant financial incentive to file and obtain injunctive relief. And this is because the loss that national health authorities suffer as a result of the injunction may not always be compensated should it be discharged. So in those cases, the patentees keep the gains. And here is some data on interim injunctions in pharmaceutical versus generic cases from 1996 to 2024, Note that the data is backwards looking. I'm not trying to predict anything. I'm not trying to model anything. I'll leave that to the computer scientists or the Mateos of the world. And this data is just looking at, of the injunctions that were granted or upheld or refused by the courts, was that the correct or the incorrect decision? So a injunction that was granted or upheld, a correct decision means that the patentee won at trial. An incorrect result is that they lost at trial. This data is on 37 cases on interim injunctions. And note that the data is from publicly available decisions on Bailey or Westlaw, but there are obviously unpublished decisions here, and those are not captured in the data set. The data also ends in 2024, trying to update it to include 2025 and 2026, but I have an 11-month-old baby, and so this depends on his temperament. Another thing that you can't see here, and this is probably not going to come as a big surprise to many of you, but most interim injunctions in these cases concern secondary patents. But the biggest finding of all is that the data indicates that of the granted or upheld injunctions, this was the incorrect result in 69.6% of cases. And as such, the cross undertaking in damages is of really great importance because that seeks to restore the party's position but for the injunction. And the cross undertaking in damages is a legally binding promise that the applicant makes to court, promising to compensate the defendant for losses suffered as a result of the injunction should it be discharged. It's commonly referred to as the price that applicants must pay for injunctive relief. And as such, it can be used to counteract abusive interim injunctions and the consequences thereof. But the question that I ask myself in my research is the cross undertaking currently fulfilling this aim? But before we get into that, it's important to note that if the injunction is discharged, the courts decide whether to enforce it and what damages should amount to. And when calculating damages under the cross-undertaking, the courts enforce the cross-undertaking in accordance with its terms. The approach is on compensation. It doesn't seek to punish patentees who have obtained injunctive relief, and the assessment is the same as for breach of contract. I'm first going to look at the cross-undertaking from the perspective of generic companies before turning to the NHS. And so damage inquiries on a cross-undertaking in these cases are quite rare. Parties appear to often settle amongst themselves, but there are two cases which calculate the damages owed to generic companies, namely Servier versus Apotex and AstraZeneca versus KC, and that does not stand for King's Counsel, it's just an abbreviation. But both of these cases demonstrate that calculating a generic company's loss is very difficult in terms of precision and certainty. This is especially the case for the loss of the first mover advantage, namely being the advantage of being the first generic to enter the market. But it's also very difficult to quantify damages if several generics are expected to enter the market in a relatively short period of time. The main uncertainties relate to estimating what the generic price would have been, how much of the market they would have captured, the timeline of everything, would other actors have entered the market, when would they have entered, what would they have priced their generic at, how would that affect the price, and so forth. And in my view, it's just much more difficult to estimate what would have happened rather than looking at what actually did happen. Because unlike originator companies who've already sold the medicine for years, judges may have little to no previous sales data that they may use when quantifying a generic company's loss. And I'm now going to show how just small changes, even just a £1 difference, can have a huge effect on the quantum of damages. So in the Servier case, the judge awarded Apotex between 17 to 18 million in damages in addition to interest. But if the judge had used a unit price of £7.50, which is much closer to the price that Apotex launched when it was on the market for 6 days pre-injunction, rather than £6.50, which is what the judge used in the damage inquiry, in other words, a £1 difference, damages would have been 19.79 million, all other factors staying the same. And this shows how relatively minor decisions, such as the unit price or £1 difference, can have a major effect. The same applies to the market share and the likelihood prediction. And in this table, I play around with the numbers, obviously showing how Apotex could have had more in damages, but the same obviously it could lower the damage calculation. But it begs the question, how close are the damages awarded to generics actually to their loss? And are damages an adequate remedy to generics taking into account all of this uncertainty? Another thing to note is that the $17 to $18 million which was awarded to Apotex, that is significantly less than the $200 million in damages which the NHS is currently claiming from Servier under competition law for exactly the same drug and for exactly the same market delay. And this shows that it is not the generic who suffers the greatest financial loss, it is the national health authorities. They are the biggest loser. And this is because they must continue reimbursing the more expensive patented drug whilst the injunction remains in effect. And without being covered by the cross undertaking, they're not entitled to damages unless they rely on another cause of action, such as competition law. And although the NHS was not covered in the Servier case, it has been possible to include third parties in the cross undertaking since the 1980s when the court started to do it in the banking sector. But there has been some confusion over the years regarding the position of third parties and the cross undertaking. And the NHS admittedly has not always made use of this opportunity, even though they have been aware of it. But in 2019, the UK Patents Court Guide included a section specifically dedicated to the NHS, and the guide now provides that the court will consider whether patentees should give an undertaking in favor of the NHS, and that applicants must email the Department of Health when applying for injunctive relief. But even after this change, it remained unclear when the NHS has, whether they are making use of this opportunity, what makes it very difficult for an external researcher like myself is that oftentimes they're not mentioned in the case law at all, and you do not have access to the orders unless you pay a little fee in the solicitor's portal, but that becomes very expensive when you're looking at so many cases. And there are also opinions out there that the NHS is systematically not joining. And so an unnamed assistant general counsel of a European pharmaceutical company has notably stated that it has been around for a while. I also don't really see the NHS intervening, but we'll have to see. This is only a big deal if the NHS bothers to intervene, and past experience shows that they're not keen to press for damages. So is this true? This data provides a glimpse of the NHS approach to the cross undertaking from 2015 to 2025. The data is on 17 cases. Note that the data is only from the Patents Court or orders from the Patents Court. There's nothing here from the Court of Appeal or the Supreme Court. And before I get into it, I really would like to thank Mr. Justice Richard Need and Dimon Fonjamala. Sorry, I'm getting a little bit of a cold. For sharing the relevant orders with me. This research would not have all been possible without them. And there are a couple things to note. The data confirms that the NHS was notified in 11 of the 17 cases. In the other cases, it's unclear from the documents on file. The NHS was covered by the cross undertaking in 7 cases where injunctive relief was granted. In 3 cases, they were not covered. In 5 cases where injunctive relief was refused, the NHS did not join. But in 1 case where injunctive relief was refused, there was proposed wording to cover the NHS should the injunction be granted. So the NHS is definitely more involved than what I initially thought, but there are obviously still some cases where they're not joining, as you can see in the 2025 Sandoz versus Bayer case. And another thing to note is that the data is only concerns when they apply to join the cross undertaking, but there's little to no information about whether they actually enforce it. And there's still no damage inquiry on the NHS, so it remains equally unclear the amount that they're actually owed and the amount that they actually receive, for example, through a settlement. But even if they do join, recovery will still likely not be 100%. So as Lord Justice Floyd, as he then was, has stated, it is true that the National Health Service will not achieve 100% recovery under the cross undertaking, which it has been offered. That is, of course, unfortunate, but it is the case whenever the court grants an injunction to restrain sales of a pharmaceutical but turns out not to be justified. And recovery will likely not be 100% due to all the uncertainties that are also present when calculating a generic company's loss. But that then again begs the question, are damages an adequate remedy for the NHS? The situation is obviously even worse when they do not apply to join at all. Then patentees are in a win-win situation. They make more in profits than they ever have to pay in damages. And so this was a glimpse of my current research, but I am looking at some other solutions and some other future research directions. And that is, why is the NHS not always joining to apply as a beneficiary of the cross undertaking? Are there other ways that they can claw back the money? And are those other clawback ways sufficient? Should we use a game-based approach to calculate damages under the cross undertaking? This could be perhaps a more controversial take, but there have several judges have suggested this throughout the years. But then we need to decide, how would this look like? Do we make an exception for these types of cases? Or do we use a game-based approach to calculate damages under all cross undertakings? And why do we use this fictional contract to do that? Third, should the courts just refuse more interim injunctions, thereby avoiding all these issues in the first place? What would that look like? Is there a basis to say that damages are an adequate remedy for pharmaceutical companies? Or are they? Alternatively, could the courts raise the bar under step one of the criteria? And are there perhaps some lessons to be learned here from continental Europe? And I would just like to say, yeah, thank you. But before that, I really would like to thank many members of the audience who have taken the time to discuss this research with me. I won't be naming any names, but the research, it's very practitioner focused, and it would not have all been possible without many of you.
I was impressively succinct given the problems you have with the technology. Since we have 5 minutes, let's explore one of your research questions a little more, which is the extent to which the NHS stroke Department of Health are more active can become more active. Because for those of you in the room who don't know, in the AstraZeneca litigation last year, they did actually intervene, which was quite unusual. And not only that, they eventually, although they didn't at first instance when it got to the appeal stage, they did actually put some evidence in. But it didn't help for other reasons. And I wonder if you have any further light you can shed on that question.